Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi. We're here to get smarter, faster, together with original, memorable insights, or OMI, from new nonfiction by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode...
Hello, I'm Alistair Campbell. I'm the author of Living Better, and this is my OMI for Bookomi.
The communicator, best-selling author, diarist, strategist, mental health campaigner, and bagpipe player, whose high-octane career in newspapers and politics, most notably as the mastermind of New Labour's success in the 90s and noughties, fueled an addictive personality through victories at the highest level of government to the rock bottom of personal breakdown, depression, and private grief.
When you're in a ruminating spiral, which often is how depression feels, when you're in that ruminating spiral, you absorb all the kind of stuff that other people have to go through, and you sort of blame yourself.
In his latest book, Living Better, How I Learned to Survive Depression, Alistair Campbell has written a love letter of sorts to the people and the places that have shaped who he is today. From his childhood growing up as the son of a vet in Yorkshire, to the friends, family and colleagues who helped him to face his demons and make a difference to the way we all approach our own mental health. Alistair, welcome to Bookomi.
My pleasure, thank you.
We always start off by asking our guests how writing their book changed them and what insights they gathered along the way. But for you, the ability to write has always been a part of your mental process, hasn't it? And this book in particular feels like a working out of issues arising before and during the pandemic. How have the last 12 months changed you?
I mean, you're right that writing has always been that kind of vehicle for me. And, you know, we've talked before about looking at now, the thing on my wall, which is a quote from Marilyn Monroe, Think in Ink. I always try to write through problems and think of them in that way. And I guess that does inevitably mean that, you know, I write every day. This book, it sort of emerged in there because I could have written this book at any point, really, in the last sort of 15, 20 years. And it emerged actually from a BBC documentary I made about depression because, you know, I would, just to give you one example, there's a lot of my psychiatrist in the book. Well, for the documentary, I persuaded David Sturgeon, my psychiatrist, I persuaded him to let the cameras come in to film one of our sessions. And that's quite a big thing for a psychiatrist to do. And he's not one of those guys who wants to sort of throw himself in front of the cameras. So I persuaded him to do that. And then when it came to the final edit, with so much other material, it made about 5 or 6 seconds. And likewise, some of these scientists that I spoke to and some of these research programs that were going on, you know, it was a good program, I think, but it was like you're inevitably compressing and cutting it down. So I thought, I've got a lot of stuff here that maybe could make a book. And then I thought, well, maybe this is the time to tell the whole kind of, I hate the word journey, but my kind of mental health narrative of my life, if you like, which I've told bits and pieces of it before, but I just decided to put it all together. And it was, how did it change me? The book, I really enjoyed writing, actually. I found it quite therapeutic. And then, of course, COVID-19 came along, postponed the book. We've all of us had to adapt to COVID in different ways. And I definitely feel at the end of the process, I'm glad that it's out there now. I'm glad that I can get out and talk on it and campaign on it. But it's still very, very weird. If we didn't have COVID, you and I would be doing this in a nice room somewhere with a nice big audience. And, you know, it would feel a lot warmer. We're having to do it online and it's very different. Likewise, there are no big events. But I think in terms of and what I always hoped that it would do, I think I can still do the things with it I want to do.
We've just had to adapt, haven't we? And I know it suddenly felt like everything just got, the plug just got pulled in March. And you stepped out of it yourself anyway, didn't you? You put yourself into isolation. But that, for you, connection and with people is a source of energy to you, isn't it? So suddenly you had an energy source cut off.
I think that's right. And that's why, so I actually hadn't thought of that because I actually had quite a bad manic spell into the sort of halfway through lockdown. And I wonder, just listening to you say that, whether that was a kind of a reaction to having to find that energy from somewhere else. And yeah, I mean, I'm somebody who I can live with myself. I can enjoy my own company, but I definitely feed off other people and I feed off other ideas. And I like kind of just bouncing around the place. And I actually wrote the book in, to some extent, bouncing around the place. I mean, because I'm very good at writing on planes, I'm very good at writing on trains and when I'm traveling and in hotels and all that sort of stuff. And last year was, you know, a much, much, much busier year for me in terms of travel and stuff. Of course, that's just all gone. So yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't thought of that, but I think you could be right. I think it could be that need for people.
And at the risk of sounding like your psychiatrist, David Sturgeon, can we talk about your childhood for a second?
Yes.
growing up, moving from Keighley, where it sounds like you had an almost idyllic upbringing, but it was cut short in a way to move to Leicester as an outsider, doggedly wearing your Burnley scarf, to Cambridge as an outsider, to all the poshos, as you call them, to newspapers as a left-leaning journalist in the Thatcher years and the age years. You revelled in opposition in that tension. And then as an adult, you found yourself in the heart of government with Tony Blair and New Labour in 1997 running things. The establishment, was that where you felt you belonged eventually? And was it hard to find a new summit, a new belonging, after you left office in 2003?
Yeah, it's funny, see, I never fully felt that I was. People think it's ridiculous when I say this, because I guess I am, to some extent, part of the establishment. I never felt that. You know, I refused to go in the House of Lords. I always kind of, I still sort of raged against the poshos with the pinky rings and all that stuff, and the old Etonians, and there's plenty of them around in government. So I don't think that I ever felt fully that I belonged. And I do think that's a theme. I mean, you've obviously read the book pretty carefully. I think you've probably got the makings of a good psychiatrist, because you're definitely onto something there. I grew up in Yorkshire. I did feel at home there. I don't think anybody's childhood is kind of idyllic, but I sort of have, any memories I have of it are good memories. I felt at home there. I felt that was where my family belonged. And with the kind of very strong Scottish connections as well, because my parents were Scots, and playing the bagpipes and, you know, travelling to Scotland any time that we could and all that. And then we got moved because my dad, who was a vet, had an accident, and he had to give up his practice. He got a job with the Ministry of Agriculture, and it meant we could get moved anywhere. We got moved to Leicester. And I've got nothing against Leicester, but I wasn't very happy there. And yeah, that is definitely, I felt that sense of being an outsider the whole time. And it's true, the Burnley scarf, I literally never, ever took it off in the classroom. And the teachers tried to get me, and I said, no, I'm not taking it off. And I had a really dingy blue anorak as well. I never took that off either. So I was kind of saying I'm different most of the time as well.
And you're right, movingly, as you would do, about your family, and in particular your older brothers, Graham and Donald, who both died age 62, both before their time, and also your friend and colleague, Philip Gould, who passed at the same age, really. You've lost relatives to suicide. No grief is greater, you say, than that. For someone so full of energy as you are, such a force of nature, how did you deal with death? Does it make you want to work even harder to make the most of the life that you have?
It was interesting, actually, when I did go through the book, and I hadn't planned to write a specific chapter about grief, because I knew I was going to write about my brothers. I knew I was going to write a chapter about my cousin who killed himself, because I wanted to defend him in a way from this thing that people say about people who take their own lives, that they're somehow selfish because they don't think about the people they left behind. I think he probably thought of nothing else, and he probably thought he was making life better for them. But then, as I went through it, I just realised when I wrote down the number of people that are close to me who died, you know, my best friend in journalism died young, my best friend in politics died young. I've had a lot of close friends who've died, both my parents, both my brothers. And I think, does it make you think in the way that you were saying? Maybe it does, but I think I've always been, so I remember when he was first diagnosed with schizophrenia, I remember studying it and I remember reading something, and it really took me aback, but it stuck with me. That on average, people who are on a lifetime of antipsychotic drugs, it takes on average 20 years from their life. Well, Donald was 62, my dad was 82 when he died. That is bang on the money in terms of that. Graham, my second brother, he was much more kind of, you know, he died, he never really made the most of his potential, I would say. And, you know, I'm saying nothing that I didn't say to him many times, but remember he had a double amputation when he was ill. Not long before he died, and I remember him saying, you know, here we go, one for the booze and one for the fags, legs off. And, you know, his death was to some extent more upsetting, because I feel that Donald, even though, in fact, because he had this horrific illness to deal with, he actually did make an awful lot of his life, considering he had that hanging around him the whole time. So they were very different. We're all very different. You know, but yeah, so I guess part of it was wanting to kind of pay tribute to their lives as being very different to mine, if you like.
And without me trying to put a square peg in a round hole here. You do mention unfairness, and you talk about it with your brothers as well, about the sense of unfairness of, you know, people being taken too soon. And in your political life and your campaigning life, that seems to be one of the things that really presses your buttons if something seems unfair or unjust. And do you think that's kind of where it comes from, is that you want to put things right, you want to make things better?
Yeah, but I think I've always had that, but not always necessarily in a political context. I mean, Fiona, my partner, has written a chapter in the book, and she says that, you know, I'm somebody who, if I see a problem, I think I can fix it.
And, yeah. And
if I see a problem that I think I can fix, I go to try to fix it. And of course, often you can't fix the problem.
Even if it's not your problem.
Well, exactly. You know, so like, and then you take on this whole thing about, I've written a chapter about guilt, and you take on the guilt, you know. So I talked to a different psychiatrist about this when I was researching the book. And when I was talking about my relationship with Donald, my brother, he said I had a classic survivor guilt. I was sort of thinking, well, why did he get schizophrenia? I only had one episode of psychosis. That's not fair. Why did I go on to have the sort of life that I've had and have a family and with children and a long-term partnership that has survived? And Donald had a very brief marriage, no kids. And so, yeah, I do maybe, when you're in a ruminating spiral, which often is how depression feels, when you're in that ruminating spiral, you absorb all the kind of stuff that other people have to go through, and you sort of blame yourself.
I think a lot of people listening at home will relate to the intense influence that key relationships, like spouses and kids especially, have on our mental health. But yeah. Fiona, you mentioned Fiona Miller, your wife, she writes a chapter in the book, and I think anyone who lives with someone suffering from depression in any form will find her words incredibly helpful. Personally, I could relate to the way you describe feeling helpless at times, and how arguments can trigger, just an argument can trigger massive mood swings. And then they make you want to shut everyone off, almost protecting them from your mood. And then you feel bad because you don't want to be so susceptible to anything. You want to be kind of almost impenetrable, don't you? You don't want to be susceptible to those mood swings. So you're almost annoyed that you got annoyed in the first place.
Yeah, but it's like, in Fiona's chapter, and by the way, she's my partner, not my wife.
Sorry, my mistake.
She always shouts at the radio when they say that. But she in this chapter, she's recalled this incident, which we do laugh about now, but at the time it must have been horrific for her. So I was in a bit of a plunge. And often I found that the start of holidays was a very kind of fragile, precarious
absolutely
moment.
Absolutely. Yeah,
I often feel like crash at the start of a holiday. So we're driving down to France, me, Fiona, the three children, but you know, the car full of luggage and bikes and all this sort of stuff, and I've got a real thing about bags and all that. It's one of my kind of, you know, my buttons that gets touched if we've got too much luggage. And we stop at this service station, and as Fiona says in her chapter, she goes in, she comes out, she's bought me a ham baguette. And I go, I just explode and say, you know, I hate ham. You know I hate ham. And she says, and that's the first I'd ever, ever heard him express any view about ham in that way. And what she realised, you know, what is taken as a... But the thing is, she rightly records, we then didn't speak for like 3 days, first 3 days of a holiday. And like, I'm sort of in a massive rage. And, you know, looking back at that, and I don't know how she stayed with me, to be honest, because it's like, what was that about? And obviously, the only way I can rationalize it is that actually it had nothing to do with the baguette. It had nothing to do with anything that was actually happening. I was just kind of, you know, I was on the downhill slalom and I was feeling desperate and helpless and I couldn't do anything about it. And I'm afraid you do that thing if you take it out on the person closest to you. And, you know, I think a lot of people will identify with that as well.
That first night away thing in a you know, a foreign place or an alien environment, maybe it's the change, maybe it's the change in pace, the change in energy, but it sort of immediately makes you raw, doesn't it? I generally, and I'm hoping it's not going to continue, but have had a series of sleepless nights every first night of a holiday, and it's terrible because you kind of you see it coming. You see,
well, I'm better now, but I used to be the same at weekends. You'd go through the rhythm of the week. You kind of, your whole upbringing, your school life, your kind of my life in journalism, what have you, there was always this sense of there's a weekend coming and that's going to feel different. And then suddenly I'm in a job where it didn't feel different at all. I was still working as hard on a Saturday to Sunday as I was Monday to Friday. And that then drags you down. And so, you know, I think a lot of the time, and I've talked to my kids about this since, that, you know, their sense of me a lot of the time was that I wasn't there. And then when I was there, I wasn't there either. So that is, you know, that's one of the reasons why I now am very, very open with them about whenever I'm kind of feeling a bit, you know, fragile, a bit edgy.
And part of that opening up, your podcast, Football Feminism and Everything in Between with your daughter Grace, is brilliant. And I really enjoyed the one you did with Scarlett and Richard Curtis, as I mentioned, I'm a dad of girls. And I found it fascinating. I wasn't quite sure who I related to more, her as the kid or you as the dad. And I found, have you got to know her better through doing the podcast? Has it been good for your relationship? Has it been good for you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the thing started, it was all a bit random, really, because what happened was I was bizarrely standing in for Nigel Farage on an LBC show. And one of my roles, editor-at-large of the New European, we'd actually given the whole paper over to women for 1 week only to do this big thing about feminism. And Grace phoned in as I was doing this and basically said, what right have you got to talk about feminism? You know, I've never seen you make a cup of coffee. You still call women birds, and all, she sort of raged at me. And then that became quite funny, and it sort of, you know, it had a certain amount to cut through. And then, because the podcast thing, she'd been trying to get me to do a podcast on my own for ages, and I just wasn't kind of really up for it. I thought, you know, I've got enough on. But then, yeah, so we've ended up doing it. I think I've enjoyed it, you know, and obviously I kind of raid my contacts book and we get good guests. But actually, during lockdown, it was just the two of us talking, and now. And I have enjoyed that. And, you know, Grace is somebody who is very, very open about mental health. She's had big anxiety issues and she's kind of right out there as a personality. And so, yeah, we've got a very good relationship. I mean, I've got three very, very strong children. They've got very different, they've got some similarities, some differences, but they all challenge me in different ways. And they do. I mean, I think they are, Fiona and the kids, without doubt, are the key relationships in my life. No doubt about it.
And again, I think everyone will relate to that. That if they're not right, or if you feel you feel helpless if you can't do anything about that, and then the whole world is coloured by that, isn't it? I don't understand. I'm always impressed by people who can have volatile domestic situations or stuff going on with their family or their kids or their wife or partner, and then go to work and they can, you know, as if it's not happening. I don't understand how they manage to do it.
Well, sometimes it's, I guess, a form of escape, that, you know, when you have something else that you can concentrate on, you can just briefly push that to one side. But, you know, I say in the book, and I'm not claiming any originality for this because it's something I've heard other people say many, many times, but I genuinely believe you are, as a parent, you are never happier than your least happy child. And if any of our children are, you know, going through a rough time, I get very down about it. And it's back to the thing about thinking I ought to be able to fix it. And, you know, I describe in the book about Callum, who's our second son. And he, you know, he had real, real problems with alcohol, and he's now, touch wood, he's 7 years sober. He's a regular at AA. He's just done an amazing job on this film Rising Phoenix, which you may have heard about the Paralympics. And he's kind of, you know, he's got his life back on track. But, you know, that period was worse than anything, that, because when I was living it for myself, when it's me that had a breakdown, when it was me that was struggling with alcohol, when it's me that's in the middle of a depression, you're so kind of wrapped up in yourself that when it's your son or when it's somebody very, very close to you, and you do feel that is real helplessness, because, you know, you really do think you ought to be able to fix it. And you can't. Ultimately, you can give them all the love and support you want, but until they make the decision, they're going to sort this themselves and you're going to help them, then it's very, very difficult. So that was a really really grim period.
It is. It's meant to be the most natural thing in the world, isn't it? It's meant to be the thing that you should naturally be able to sort out. And getting to know you through your diaries and meeting you all the times we've met, the penny sort of slightly dropped, because when we first met a few years ago, I thought, how can I have a conversation with someone who's dealt with so many, you know, large global issues? You know, we've all had stress and work stress and things in life, but I've never negotiated a peace agreement or, you know, do you know what I mean? It's the scale of the things that you're involved with. But then as I got to know you, I realized that if you get to the eye of the storm, if you're made the way you're made, you're actually almost comfortable in that area because you feel right at the center of it. You feel like you can affect change. You can influence it. And when I've worked in jobs which have been very stressful, I can remember somebody saying, how do you manage to do that? Be, you know, emailing late at night and up early in the morning. And it's because I felt part of it. I didn't feel stressed. I felt, well, obviously there was probably a lot of low level stress building up, but that penny dropped with me when I'm thinking about you and your career is that it's not the subject matter. It's not the level of intellectual or physical stress around you. It's whether you can affect it or influence it. Am I right in reading that? Or is that kind of a fair assessment of where you are, where you've been?
I do think that I gravitate towards, and David, my psychiatrist, says in the book, he thinks that my demon is this gravitational pull towards political argument, a political debate, a political campaign, and even though I know it might not be very good for my health. And certainly, it's interesting, I did an interview about football yesterday, and the guy that was doing the interview, he said, you know, during the COVID thing, I mean, you just feel amazing that you have such kind of, you know, influence on the debate and, you know, your voice is everywhere. And I said, that is really weird that you say that, because I feel utterly powerless. I feel I have no influence on the debate at the moment at all.
I think a lot of people feel like that. So
maybe when we were in government and I was alongside Tony Blair and I was able to sort of, you know, be part of something that was making a difference, I did feel, you know, that I was in the place I was meant to be. I did feel that. But it doesn't mean I was enjoying it all the time. I was happy all the time, but I did feel a kind of, And I am somebody who will, I think sometimes in politics, you've got to be really careful about this, because I think sometimes there's almost a desire to run towards crisis, to have something really big to sort out. And you've got to be careful about that. Sometimes the sort of, you know, slow and stable is okay.
So how do you, to the practical part of the book, really, because it's packed with decent tips and insights and lists of your own wants and needs and gratitudes and resentments. How do you deal with your own, as you call it, bastard depression? It's a palpable grey cloud, isn't it? And to see it coming, you have a scale of 1 to 10 and then a jam jar. How do they work together?
So most of the time I'm fine, right? Most of the time I'm absolutely fine. I'm a kind of pretty even keel. I've got a lot of energy. I've got a good life and I enjoy it most of the time. The depressions, when they come on, it's not always the same, but generally I feel this slight heavying in my mood. It often comes on when I wake up, and I wake up and I just feel very heavy in my head and heavy in my chest. I sometimes have this really horrible metallic taste in my mouth. And then I will open my eyes and it's almost like I see, it's not there, it's not like a kind of vision, but in my mind's eye, there's this kind of, it's shaped like a very large rugby ball. And it's like a jelly amorphous thing. It kind of, it's not concrete, it moves around, it's got, you know, it's sort of just wobbly. And it's kind of moving towards me, and I'm telling it to F off, and I'm saying, look, you know, go away, leave me alone. And then after a few minutes of struggle, sometimes it might be a day or two of struggle, but, you know, in the end I give up and I say, okay, you know, you've got me again, you bastard. And then it's almost like a kind of physical feeling of your body and your mind being taken over with this horrible, heavy, dark, just sort of feel that sludge going through your body. And then life becomes a struggle. That's when, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, once I'm over the 5 into the 6, 7, 8, I'm in trouble. And I'm, you know, very, very simple things become quite difficult. And as for the strategies, I mean, one of the things I do, the reason I give myself this scale of when I wake up and say, like, so this morning I woke up, I was about 3.5, which is pretty good. And that's no problem. I get out of bed. I went out to do the Jeremy Vine program. I'm now talking to you. I've got lots on during the day. Fine. I don't have any worries. Other days, if I'm feeling a bit sort of 5, 6, then I know there are certain things that I have to do. It's really interesting how many men relate to this whenever I've said this before, but shaving, I have to shave. If I don't shave, I know that I'm letting myself go. If I don't, we've got a blind on the landing outside our bedroom. If I don't open that and let some light in, I know that I'm dipping. The other thing with me, it's a very physical thing. I mean, sometimes you can tell with me when I'm depressed because literally my voice weakens. Physically, my voice sounds a lot weaker than it normally does. Fiona spots that straight away. My eyes look different. I have a look in my eyes. And I just sort of, it's hard to describe really. I mean, when you're not depressed, it's very hard to describe what it's like. But that's the best description I've ever come up with was when you imagine, try to imagine feeling dead and alive at the same time. That's what it feels like.
And what does Fiona do when she sees that in you?
Well, she's got better because what she used to do was kind of say, what's wrong? How did it start? What can I do? And let's do this. Why don't we do this? Why don't we do that? Now she's, and the other thing she used to do, she's written about this. She used to blame herself. She used to think it must be something about her. So she puts on a bit of a shield for it. She doesn't allow it to overwhelm her in the way that maybe sometimes it did. And that actually, I think that has helped both of us because one of the worst things about when you're feeling depressed is you feel crap anyway, but you feel worse because you know that you're having that effect on other people around you as well. And that makes you feel even worse. And that increases the helplessness because you keep saying, so why can't I just smile? Why can't I just, and literally with Fiona, I would go days. That ham baguette incident, I literally wouldn't speak. We'd wake up in the morning, she'd say, how are you feeling? I sort of wouldn't speak. So she's got much, much better. I've got much better now. What I do now is the minute I start to feel I'm going down, I tell her straight away.
And that almost, I mean, the fact that someone's almost in it with you from the beginning makes it less problematic. So how does the jam jar work then?
So the jam jar, what happened with the jam jar was I went to Canada to talk to a woman called Janine Austin, who's a genetic counsellor. And I was actually there to talk to her about, explore whether there's a genetic element to mental illness. And I was asking her about the kind of possible genetic background to this. And she says, it's not like Huntington's disease, where if you've got that gene, you know you're going to pass it on. That we all have some susceptibility to mental illness, and we all probably have something in our background. But it doesn't mean just because your father took his own life, just because your mother was a depressive, just because your granddad was had schizophrenia, that does not mean that you are going to get that. So what she says we should do, I'm now holding a jam jar, which I've got on my desk. And so basically at the bottom of the jam jar, imagine the sediment, and that is your genes. There's nothing you can do about that. It's always going to be there. And then the rest of the jam jar is your life, and it fills up with good things and bad things and good memories and bad memories. And most of them disappear. Most of them we don't even remember. But then your life, sometimes the jar is full, sometimes it is less full. And what happens when it's overfull, it becomes unmanageable, is that it explodes, and the explosion is illness, okay? And she says, we spend so much time trying to undo the contents of the jam jar, when what we should be doing is trying to extend the jam jar so that we can put more life into it. And what she meant by that was each of us individually draw, and I've got, there's an illustration at the back of the book that people can do this for themselves if it's helpful, draw what helps you. And when I did that, it's since then, it's completely changed the way I think about my own depression. So if you'd have said to me the day before I met her, you know, how do you deal with your depression? How do you stay on an even keel most of the time? I said, well, I take sertraline every morning and it really helps. And I see a psychiatrist and I talk things through, that really helps. I would have said that. I'd have given you a medical response. Now I'd give you, the medication would probably come 20th on my list of things that I now focus on. So for example, my big thing, I call it FFF, Fiona Family Friends, focus on that. I then have meaningful activity and have it in two sections, paid and unpaid. I want to make a living, although not much of that going on at the moment with COVID, but I want to make a living so we can have a nice life, but I also want to do stuff for charities and campaigns and stuff like that. Then I go into what I call the kind of the basic fundamentals that I think all of us can and should do. And the three big ones for me are sleep, diet, and exercise. And I never used to take those seriously, any of them. Sleep, I thought was a waste of time. Diet, I thought was just a fancy load of nonsense. If you can drink and you can cope with it, just do it. If you eat crap food, so what? And exercise was kind of just something for weirdos. I now do those three things religiously. And then into the more personal stuff. So like for me, bagpipes, Motown, Jack Brel, Burnley Football Club, foreign languages, keeping up my French, keeping up my German, creativity, curiosity, countryside, my dog. All of these things are a really, really important part of my mental well-being. And if I start to feel myself going to a plunge, I get the jam jar out, I have a look at it, I say, okay, what are you going to do on that today? And it might mean I just decide, right, I'm going to go down and I'm just going to tell Fiona how fantastic she is. I'm going to take the dog for a walk. I'm going to phone one of the Burnley players and have a natter. I'm going to play my bagpipes. I'm going to listen to Jack Brel. I'm going to listen to Elvis. You know, whatever it might be, the things that I know can have a positive effect on my mood, I'll just dive into them.
And it is possible, isn't it? And you talk about, sometimes when we're talking about your depression and you describe it, I do worry sometimes when I'm having these discussions, because I'm susceptible to it too, the power of suggestion, yeah. You know, and CBT uses this a lot as well, doesn't it? And talking things through can also talk you towards thinking things as well. But you've just described there how powerful suggestions and actions can be when they're in your control. It's not necessarily, you're not helpless. If you just have a simple image like a jam jar and you list the things that do actually have a positive effect on your well-being, your mental health.
And I know, I've done that. I've done it. I describe an episode in the book where I felt myself, it was a rare one for me because it was almost like it was instantaneous. It was like a switch going off. And I actually disappeared for a few hours. I went and hid. And then the next morning, I decided I'm just going to do that. I'm going to do something related to my jam jar today. Now, what's interesting is that episode didn't last as long as they normally do. Now, it could have been something to do with something else, but I think it helped me. And, you know, this thing about the other, there's lots of reasons why I've written this book. But one of them is that I do think, I mean, I took a lot of strength when I was recovering from a breakdown, from hearing from other people who'd kind of got through stuff. And last night I did this phone-in on LBC, and I mentioned this thing about the metallic taste, this taste of lead in my mouth whenever I get a bad depression. And this woman phoned up, and it was a fantastic sort of thing because she said, look, I just can't believe you said that because I get that, and I've been saying it to doctors, and they just won't listen to me about what it is. And just to hear that somebody else has that feeling and I'm not crazy. It was like, so, you know, and then once you know that you're not crazy, it's just that is a symptom of me and of her, as it happens also of Denise Welsh, she said the same thing, that there's a kind of, you can then think, well, I'm not totally on my own on this, because what the one of the worst things about depression when it's really bad is the sense of utter isolation. You can't imagine that anybody else feels like that. So, and it, that's what I mean about you suddenly get completely wrapped up in yourself. But if you can then at that point say, well, do you know what? That guy's thinking that, and he got through it. And you can get that strength from other people.
And it is manageable as well. I mean, you spent years refusing to get help, didn't you? You spent years self-treating and saying, you know, in a kind of slightly macho way, unreconstructed male, I'll sort this out. This is all I need to do is just work harder at it.
Yeah, exactly. I think we do that. And look, I know as well, I mean, because I get lots of people now sort of asking if I can help them and or get help for them. More usually it's people who phone me up because they've got a relative or a friend and they say, what do you think I should do? What should I say? And what have you? And it is, if the person doesn't want to see somebody professionally, it's very, very hard to persuade them. But I always say to people that the two things that have definitely helped me the most, apart from the obvious, which is, you know, Fiona and family and so forth, is my openness about it. I've never, ever, ever regretted that. I feel a lot better for being open about it. And the second thing is that I found the right guy for me in 2005, and I was very lucky in doing that. And I think one of the reasons I resisted getting any help for a long time was because my first experience with psychiatry was seeing my brother in hospital, and that was a very mixed picture. In a military psychiatric hospital, it wasn't the greatest of environments. My second experience for myself was a really good one when I was in hospital in 1986. My next experience when my GP sent to see somebody was terrible. I really didn't like the guy, and I just felt he'd really got my back up. And that made me resistant. And then 2005, I found a guy who, you know, really has helped. And one of the other things I put into the book, as you say, a lot of the exercises I've done with him, a lot of the discussions that we've had, and I hope that people can see them and, you know, get something out of them. Because, so, you know, even a really simple one, you mentioned it, the thing about, you know, when you feel yourself going down a bit, just literally back to thinking in ink, write down a list of the things for which you feel gratitude, write down a list of the things for which you feel resentment. And when he asked me to do it, I thought, what the hell is this about? But then when I did it, I just looked at these two lists, and the gratitude list was just so, so, so much longer. And that a sort of penny dropped, and thought, you know, yeah, okay, I see. Okay, yeah, good, I like that.
And we have to self-care as well, because it is a spectrum, isn't it, depression? You aren't just suddenly depressed, you know, because lots of people are probably suffering from low-level depression around the country. And looking ahead, we are, as you say, facing a potential tsunami of depression in the wake of COVID, as people losing their sense of purpose, their sense of belonging. I mean, God, before we've had that in the run-up to Brexit, haven't we? And we won't get onto that right now. But that sense of isolation and marginalisation is what leads people into tribes and divisiveness and makes them feel alone, not least because the nature of work will change. Your book obviously was delayed because of COVID, and it's got a pandemic postscript. Mm. Apart from reading your book, though, which I strongly recommend to everyone, the going to a GP or seeking help in the National Health Service might become more problematic, because, you know, it's one thing going to your GP and saying, oh, I'm feeling a bit depressed. They might just give you medication. It might not be as involved. Getting psychiatric help is, you know, often the last resort, isn't it?
I agree. And you know, I do think it's going to be very, very difficult. And you know, I say in the postscript I've written about the COVID thing, you go through all the things that have happened, people losing their loved ones without being able to say goodbye, frontline workers who felt under kind of massive stress, and okay, we all went out and clapped for them, but you know, that's not going to butter many parsnips. And then the economic consequences of what's going to come along. And I'll tell you, I did a conference the other day for something called the Brain Center, and there was a woman, she was Spanish psychiatrist speaking on the panel. She was making the point that, you know, for children in particular, when they're growing up, their brains change shape according to you know, what experiences they're having. And if you think about how we're raised as children, you know, to hug, to cuddle, to kiss, to run to people, to smile at them, and you know, we're now telling them, don't touch, don't hold hands, don't mingle, don't mix, wear a mask. You know, that is going to change the way that children are, the way their brains are wired. So I think we've got to think that through in a way that I worry the government isn't really doing that. But the other reason, to be honest, why I've written the book is that it's not just about government. There's an awful lot we can do for ourselves. And I think businesses are very important this as well. I think businesses as employers have got massive responsibility, and it's also in their interest to look after the mental health and well-being of their staff.
Alistair, whenever I spend time with you, in words or in person, I always learn a little bit more about you and myself, actually. Thanks for sharing your OMI with Bukomi today.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it, as always.
Alistair Campbell's new book, Living Better, How I Learned to Survive Depression, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up for our most wanted email at bukomi.com. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bukomi pod, please follow us on @Bukomi on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Stay safe, wear a mask, and remember, life is for living, ups, downs, and in-betweens. Bye for now.